meeting will be held in accordance with House Rule 10.01. Roll call, Mr. Smith, please.
Chair Sundin.
Here.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Anderson.
Anderson present.
Representative Burkle.
Burkle present.
Representative Eklund.
Present.
Representative Hansen R.
Here.
Representative Hansen J.
Hansen J present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick. Representative Miller.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Thompson.
Thompson present.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have the minutes of the February 28th meeting. Representative Thompson, would you provide a motion?
Motion to move those minutes, Chair.
Okay. Any questions or corrections on those minutes? Hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Okay, that motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Three bills on the agenda today. We will lay them all over. So if members have additional questions beyond our time availability, we can ask offline if necessary. So first up, Vice Chair Vang's bill, House File 3263, has been removed and rescheduled for the March 14th meeting. First up, we have Representative Nelson. You'd like to move your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus.
Okay, we got about 15 minutes for this bill. Thanks for moving the bill, and you can explain the bill.
All right, thank you. And this is it would be a grant or other forms of compensation. I also have an A1 amendment. Should I move that, or should I explain the bill first?
Go ahead and move the A1 if you want.
Okay, I will move the A1 amendment, and this kind of adds a couple of things. On page 1, line 8, after grants, it adds other forms of financial assistance, and after line 9, it would add other training or receive a technical assistance. So just kind of more of a technical, just a couple of technicalities, so I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay, thanks for that explanation. All those in favor of the amendment, or are there any questions about that? Okay, hearing none, seeing none. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, say same sign. Okay, that's adopted. 3640 as amended is now before us. Please tell us about the bill and then introduce your witnesses, please.
Okay, so this is just a bill for it's geared towards small meat processors up to 50 full-time employees, and it's really just giving opportunity for training, and there's a growing demand in for custom processed, and you know, there used to be a local processor in just about every town in rural Minnesota, and those have kind of disappeared, and there's a growing demand for it, and one of the big hurdles that we're running into is having training and just a qualified workforce for it. So we're just giving some grants to be able to do that, and you know, whether it's through a school or to the processor, we're looking at being able to do that. And so I've got several people here to testify, and I don't know if there's any questions, but we'll be able to try to answer them at the end. So for that, I don't know who wants to be first up, but I see Greg, and I'm sorry, I don't know how to say your last name. I'm not even going to, it's probably along the name of Worcestershire sauce. I'm not even going to try to butcher it like that. So, but anyway, I'll ask Greg to go first, and then I think Amber Hansen, or there's some others here as well. So thank you.
Thank you. I'll give it a shot. Mr. Wischke from Clean Chickens and Company, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and Committee, thank you for having me today. I'm a supporter of the Land Stewardship Project.
I am the owner of Clean Chickens and Company. We are the only mobile USDA slaughter processed slaughter unit in the U.S. We're currently working on building the only halal slaughter processing plant in Willmar that would be USDA and halal certified. One of the things that we implemented this year is that we are a registered apprenticeship with the Department of Labor. We're the only agricultural meat apprenticeship in the state right now. And as I see it, this bill would give the Minnesota Department of Agriculture and the USDA a tool to help their processors. A lot of times they can't tell you what to do, and when you ask them what they would do, they can't answer that question. It's just part of meat processing. This would give them a tool to be able to send processors for further training or HACCP training. The HACCP certification is part of our apprenticeship program. It's a vital part for us to train our next leaders in our company to be able to train the next group of meat processors or meat cutters to come in. It costs us about $700 to send an apprentice to a HACCP training. My experience with Minnesota when I was trying to become USDA inspected was I called the University of Minnesota. They sent me to the extension. The extension sent me back to the University of Minnesota, and I finally went to Wisconsin for help to figure out all these small little questions that I had to get this process up off the ground. We did it, but I think there's some improvement here that we can provide to help our meat processors making this step easier. Where am I? Levi Mole from the Minnesota Department of Ag Meat Inspection Program has been great. You know, he's answered a lot of questions on the food safety, but again, this bill would give him the ability to send processors that are having trouble or that want to get inspected to have those tools. MDA and the USDA are great to work with, but they can't answer questions because you can't ask them what would you do, because you get into, you know, processor issues and business issues. Let's see. That's all I have. If you have any other
thank questions. You. Next up is Mr. Endicott from Central Lakes College. Please identify yourself and continue your testimony.
Chairman Sundin, Vice Chair Vang, members of the committee, my name is Dave Endicott. I am from Central Lakes College. I'm the Dean of Staples Campus, the Staples Career Tech Nursing and Grants here, and have been the lead in creating a meat cutting and butchery program, which we will be starting this fall, along with Ridgewater College. Both colleges will be starting programs this fall to train meat cutters. And part of that training piece is also going to be offering customized training for HACCP certification, for ProStart, Clean Safe, Clean Serve types of certifications that also go along with our culinary program. We currently have 8 students that are enrolled in the program with 50 prospects, and we just opened up for hiring today, actually. So we will have a faculty member in place, and as soon as they get in place, they will be looking at other types of potential customized training opportunities for those that are working in small and medium-sized processing plants. We are hopeful that we'll be able to connect. We've already, Mr. Wersky and I have talked, and have been working along with a number of other industry partners to see what we can offer on our end, and I know that Ridgewater will be doing the same. So these funds would really go towards helping folks come to those training opportunities that our colleges are providing, and then help us get workforce that are trained and are certified and are able to do the work that we desperately need throughout Minnesota and certainly in our region. That's kind of the update for us. Our program is a 16-credit, one-semester program, and it'll start in August of 22.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we have Amber Hansen. She's from the Farm Bureau. Please identify yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Amber Glazer. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Minnesota Farm Bureau. I just wanted to briefly offer Farm Bureau support for this bill and appreciate Representative Nelson bringing it forward. Obviously, over the past few years, we've recognized the need for local meat processing, and a key component is educational programs for meat processors. So appreciate this grant program to expand that those opportunities for our local meat processors and offer Farm Bureau support for this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have Nicole Kneeser from Dairy and Meat Inspection Division Director available if there's any questions. Thanks to the testifiers from the committee. Any questions to the author or the testifiers? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Nelson, are the grants competitive, or are they first come, first serve basis, or how are the grants distributed?
They would be on a first come, first serve basis. I don't believe they're set up in a competitive nature right now.
Okay. Anything else? Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so urban and suburban communities could apply as well. So let's say if there was a meatpacking plant in, for example, South St. Paul, they could apply for that, for these grants. It's not, or if college DCTC, for example, was looking at doing something, there's nothing that prohibits these grants going to urban or suburban areas.
Mr. Nelson?
No, there is not anything that prohibits, whether it's an urban or suburban or rural Minnesota.
Okay. Any further follow-up?
No.
Okay, thank you. Any closing comments, Representative Nelson?
I just would ask for your support, and if any further conversation, I would appreciate that. If you'd like to have, if you believe it needs to be made better, I would appreciate that, and we can carry this conversation on. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. House File 3640, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Chair Hansen, you have the next bill up. 3618, University of Minnesota Heritage Oil Seed and Grain Initiative Funding. We've got about 20 minutes or so for this bill, so I'd like to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 3618 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members and folks watching at home, the events of recent weeks show the need for resiliency and diversity in our cropping systems. We are going to have impacts from the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the reliance that we have on a world export market and input market. What is old can be new again. 100 years ago, what Minnesotans cropped was very different than what we crop now. But the University of Minnesota was a leader 100 years ago or more on developing strains of oil seeds and grains. There's things that we don't grow very much anymore that we used to grow when you look at the record of past acreages. We used to grow a lot of flax. We used to grow a lot of buckwheat. We used to grow a lot of oats and wheat. So those old crops, what this bill does is puts money into these heritage oil seeds and heritage grains to jumpstart that research. And this recognizes that research is occurring, but there are areas, not creating a new institute, not a new building with a new name on it, but putting money into programs where we can try to build that resiliency by looking at crops that we had and how we can restore them and make them available in the public sphere. So that public, the public genetics, not the private genetics, the public research for the public purpose of having that resiliency that Minnesotans can use around the state. So this would help, the funds here would help with the short-term seed storage facility upgrade and growth chamber replacement, improving, giving information to the Plant Protein Innovation Center, and then helping with that small grain research and plant breed. Mr. Chair, I think at some point we also need to look at some of the forages. Do we those old clover mixes, the Timothy mixes, some of that old orchard grass, some of those old genetics might need to be brought in as well. But I have with me today Greg Cuomo, Dr. Greg Cuomo, the Dean of Research at CFANS, who can talk a little bit about how this money would be applied. So,
Okay, thank you. Dr. Cuomo, please identify yourself. You've got one heck of a title there. If you would please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Sundin, Ranking Member Anderson, and members of the House Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee. I'm Greg Cuomo, Associate Dean for Research and Graduate Programs in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an informational presentation on HF 3618, the Heritage and Oilseed Grain Initiative. I appreciate the time today and want to thank you, Representative Hansen, for inviting me to comment. Minnesota is a global leader in agriculture and food systems, and the University of Minnesota has been a partner since its founding. The University of Minnesota delivers research discoveries such as new varieties of crops, healthier, more productive livestock, as well as the future talent of Minnesota's agricultural system needs to enable our agri-food business and community partners to thrive and grow. My intention today is to provide some ideas about where we can leverage the strength of the University of Minnesota to meet the intent of House File 3618, as I understand it, both with short-term impact and position the U for longer-term excellence. There are two components to this bill, one about propagation and maintenance of seed and the other about evaluation. The propagation and maintenance of seed is a long-term endeavor. It needs to go on in perpetuity, and it's also quite expensive. A national plant germplasm system already exists in this country, with Iowa State University having the closest facility and Colorado State University the largest. Just to give you an idea, there's a federal subsidy for the Iowa State facility of more than $522,000 a year, and that doesn't include the funds provided by the state of Iowa or the facilities. And the University of Minnesota researchers have access to and use those facilities. So when I think about this legislation, I think about what exists currently and where the University of Minnesota can add value. And that's really on the evaluation or on the research side. I've included a few ideas for consideration. First, one option for this funding is to grow the work of our Plant Protein Innovation Center. Established in 2018, the center brings together research that includes some of the crops Representative Hansen mentioned, oil seeds, legumes or pulses, and grains, with interdisciplinary teams of researchers and industry partners to study and develop plant protein ingredients and products from evaluation, breeding and genetics to processing, formulation, and marketing. The development of plant and alternative proteins is critical to addressing changing consumer demand as well as global sustainability of the food supply. Additional funding could provide critical research personnel, including graduate students and undergraduate research opportunities, supplies, and infrastructure. Secondly, to effectively evaluate oilseed and grain crops that have served the state over time, investments are also needed to upgrade core infrastructure that is a foundation of that work. Short-term seed storage facilities need to be refurbished and plant growth chambers replaced to effectively facilitate research on crop adaptation to Minnesota climates. This funding could be used for that purpose as well. We also know that small grains, wheat, barley, and oats are a key component of diversified crop rotations across the state. To date, however, disease and lack of adapted varieties have minimized economic return needed to include small grains widely in corn and soybean rotations. The university could explore using this funding to enhance variety development and breeding and genetic tools related to crop improvement for Minnesota environments. These efforts would leverage Minnesota's strengths in plant breeding, research, varietal development, and graduate education. And finally, the university would look to potential investments in our GEMS platform, or genetics by environment, by management, by socioeconomic factors. GEMS is the first and only system.
Hang on 1 second.
Certainly.
Okay, I'm sorry, that was meant to. Chair Van, can you take over for a few minutes?
I will. Go ahead, Dr. Cuomo.
Thank you, Chair Van. And finally, the university would look to potential investments in our GEMS program, which is genetics by environment, by management, by socioeconomic factors. GEMS is the first and only system designed to consider and support data across a wide range of locations and climates into a single integrated platform. GEMS enables agriculture innovation by turning big and little, often diverse, incomplete, and sometimes messy data into tangible decision-making tools to help farmers and agriculture in the agricultural industry. Developing effective management tools and systems more and more requires integration of data. Funding support to support the GEMS platform will enhance and further develop Minnesota leadership in developing environmentally and economically strong cropping systems by integrating data from around the world and developing end-user tools for retrieving actionable information. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present these potential opportunities for investment through HF 3618, and I would be happy to answer any questions people might have.
Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any more testifiers, so I will open up for discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Hansen, I think you maybe knew this question might be coming, but just the other day in committee when we were talking about, looking ahead, looking forward at the new crops available and such, and now today we're taking a look back. And I'm just trying to understand the reasoning for this. And I think back to when I started farming, the university came out with a variety of wheat called Era, one of the first of the semi-dwarf wheats. And if we got 30 or 40 bushels an acre, that was a bin buster. Well, today, we've surpassed that. The newer varieties of wheat are outstanding. So I just don't understand why we're going to look backward at older varieties to enhance the ability and profitability of grains and such in the future. If you could walk me through that, please.
Chair Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I think we can do both. We can look at the future and look at the past. And, you know, as we look at cropping, we have to look at profitability. And I think there is a market for crops that may not yield as much. There's the difference between profitability and production. So you could have a crop that maybe has a lower yield, but has a higher value. And that higher value, or that higher value per acre. And I believe there will be markets that will pay for some of these older varieties. In addition, it provides strength for the future because you have the resiliency of that diversity. If we become too narrow, and throughout history, we've seen that if we're too narrow in terms of what our crops are, then we're vulnerable because we don't have that ability to respond when things happen. So look right now, you know, there's a lot of wheat that is produced in the Ukraine. That may not be available. What if we had the ability to respond with planting wheat in Minnesota now? Do we have the ability to meet that market? Do we have the capacity to do that with even the seeds that are available? So I think of doing this basic research on the things that we had provides us with tools for the future, because we're in a very disrupted world. We've been disrupted by coronavirus. Crops are disrupted by various insects and various diseases and extreme weather. So having that resiliency with diversified crops provides us with a better foundation for the future. We have the germ, like Dr. Cuomo mentioned, we have the seed stock that is there, and we can make sure that we have that available for us. It gives us tools. Now, is it for every farmer? Is every farmer going to go out and plant flax? Probably not, but there may be some. There may be some where there's a market. What did flax get used for? Well, a lot of it went to oils for paint. There might be a market out there for flax oil for paint. We don't know. But there is such a market with the number of people that we have in the country, that providing these basic grains, whether they're oil grains, oil seeds or grains, provides us with tools for the future. And Dr. Cuomo could add to that, I think.
Dr. Cuomo, would you like to add to your response?
Just briefly, thank you, Chair Vang, Representative Anderson and the committee. I think it really is about making sure we have diversified choices. It's having a portfolio of crops, both new and old. While some of these crops are older, much of what I talked about were new uses or how to identify new markets or look for new ways to use them for a Minnesota economy.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Well, I agree with what you're saying, but I would also add that we're already doing this. I had a nephew working with a company that grew what they called heritage tomatoes, a very specialty crop using older strains, older varieties. So we're already doing this. It was a niche market. I believe they grew them in California because of the unique weather out in that area, but we're already doing this. And, the newer things, I understand the variety of our seed stock, and we have, as the doctor mentioned, in Iowa and Colorado already, and I understand the reason for this. I'm just not quite sure of the necessity here in Minnesota being done elsewhere. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next I see is Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to make a quick comment, and then I have a question for the bill's author, if possible. I understand the need for the diversity here, and part of the progression of what we've done in our industry is, when we talk about climate change and we talk about all these issues revolving around resources, and there's reasons why markets have pushed us to this direction. And so having that diversity and that seed stock and that history, I understand. But maybe if the author would deal for a quick question.
Go ahead and say your question.
I'm just curious. I mean, you mentioned flax. And what I'm trying to get at is how markets develop and how demand is created and supply is created. Do you know what the price of flax is right now as we speak?
Chair Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Burkle, I do not. But the part of the reason that I don't know that is that the value may be low, because you have the investment for the private sector into the heritage grains may not be there. The public stock can be used for the public purpose. So is there enough of a financial incentive on flax or buckwheat or timothy or red clover? Is there enough of a financial incentive for that? There may be, but we do have the public strains that we can provide for a public purpose.
Representative Burkle?
Well, it just so happens that flax is extremely high right now, upwards of $30, and I've got family members that grow it. So, the market tends to fix these things, and in this case, we'll probably be flooded with flax in the next year or two. So I just say that, while I understand what Representative Hans is trying to do here, I'm not sure why we need to have $2.5 million to do it. I think it's happening as we speak. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lipper.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment here. So as I have conversations with farmers who are excited about newer crops like Forever Green, continuous living, cover crops, they're also very eager to be integrating small grains and want as many options there as possible. So I think this bill makes sense, and I want to thank Representative Hansen for his work on it. I think protecting that diversity, protecting that seed stock is something that's very, very important. We haven't always done that, and seeing some consequences because of it. And so I think protecting that, really focusing on is protecting diversity will serve us well going forward too. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess a couple questions for Dr. Como. And I guess one, there's been a lot of general statements about the state of agriculture and the variety of small grains. Could you enlighten us a little bit on the wide potential variety of barley, for example? It's grown for a number of reasons, and so. Maybe Dr. Como could explain to us right now what kind of venues are out there, depending on what type of barley you tend to grow and who you're going to market it to?
Dr. Comel?
Chair Vang and Representative Lewick and the committee members, you know, right now, barley, I think there's a bigger issue with all with small grains in general, which is oats and barley and wheat, and that is that the primary growing regions are moving north into Canada. And so part of there are opportunities for selling these crops, certainly, and an industry certainly has a desire for production in the United States. And so what we're looking at is, if they're old crops, we're looking at, okay, how do we look at the disease? How do we look at, you know, production systems that will enable them to become part of the Minnesota economy again? I'm not an expert in small grains, Representative Lewick, but, you know, there's actually craft brewing, there's brewing industries, there's food industries. So there's places or markets, and what we're really seeing is I think there's opportunities for the state of Minnesota, but right now the growing region is pushed north into Canada.
Thank you, and I'm certainly not an expert in that area either, but I know there's an element of barley that goes into poultry feed, there's an element that goes into producing all kinds of spirits. I guess the second question, again, more on a global question, and recognize that, you know, one of the things that I think University of Minnesota suffers from sometimes is if you are from north central Minnesota or north, you look to Winnipeg and the folks up there to find the right seed varieties, the right the 80 day corn, the 75, those kind of things, which we don't necessarily look to University of Minnesota for that. We look to Canada because they've been doing that for 30 years because their climate is obviously different. But can you give me kind of a global concept of how much grain moves out of the Midwest into the Port of Duluth and where it goes? We see the railroad cars go by mile after mile of them, and they're going to Duluth. And any idea where that grain goes?
Dr. Kumbel?
Chair Bang, Representative Lewick, and the committee members. No is a short answer to your question about where the grain's growing. I would like to comment on your comment about Winnipeg and growing there. I mean, part of what we're trying to do is, you know, we're putting investment at, we have a research and outreach center system, investment at Crookston to try to look at these things and look at grain development and those kind of places. And I think what we are really aiming for, what we're trying to develop and would use this funding to help do, is to position it so that in the future you would look to the University of Minnesota.
I appreciate that. And yeah, as a bit of a student of the Port of Duluth, those are going into ocean-going vessels that go across the world. So there's a huge amount of people out there depend on what's produced in the Midwest and on the Canadian Great Plains. But no, you're exactly right, and I'm glad you recognize that point, because that is an area where, depending on where you're at in Minnesota, if you're north of St. Cloud, the Canadians, not picking on University of Minnesota, don't get me wrong, I love the organization, but they've been dealing with a climate that is a lot similar to from Grand Rapids Northwest all the way through Minnesota into the valley. That's so hopefully I don't want to go out there and steal what they're doing, but I suspect that you probably have a lot of cross-pollination with those folks up there, because I can tell you that's where a lot of people look for seed. They look to Canada because the climate in northern Minnesota, or at least from north central up, is a lot similar to that. So please look hard there. But I the generalities that we're going to have an issue with feeding ourselves. Last time I looked, there's nobody literally exports more food product than the United States of America to the rest of the world. So we just got to keep doing that. And with the help of you, Dr. Como, and the folks up there, we'll continue that. But I want to just be a little cautious about these generalities about our ability to be resilient and not just feed ourselves, but feed a lot of folks out there. So thank you.
I don't see any further questions. So any closing comments, Chair Hansen, before you renew your motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lewick, we could call this the Why Go to Winnipeg research bill then, if I'm listening to what you're saying. We can do this quality research here. It builds for the resiliency. You know, I oats, for example, depending on the rainfall and the disease, the protein content fluctuates. So, having a high protein for your Cheerios, there may have to be import. We're going to see a lot of disruption in the next few weeks as the full impact of this invasion comes. We don't know what diseases are coming in the future. We don't know what pests are coming in the future. And so this is a good insurance policy to build in the research, to go back to that model, that extension model, that research model of over 100 years ago. What this bill does is it invests in that basic research that provides Minnesotans with the resiliency. So we don't have to go to Winnipeg. We don't have to be looking around, and we can help reach those markets that are right here. I believe they are here. I believe that they can grow, and our heritage oil seeds and grains can be a part of it. So I'd ask for your support. I renew my motion that House File 3618 be laid up over for possible inclusion.
Thanks, Chair Hansen. House File 3618 is laid over. Next, we have, before we hear the last bill, I wanted to hear from the MDA on a report that was included in the Omnibus Ag Finance Bill last year on the Ag Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account. Since Representative Backer's bill led to the mandated report, we thought it would be good to hear the report before considering his bill. We have about 20 minutes for the report. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McIndes. Please tell us about your report. And I also see there are staff available for questions too as well. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will attempt to share my slides here, and then I will introduce myself, make sure that I can get that to work first. All right. So can everybody see my slides? Just the legislation from last year is what it is.
Yep, looks good.
Great. So I am Roger McInnes. I am with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. I'm the Assistant Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division. I am also the Executive Director of the Agricultural Chemical Response and Reimbursement Account. As Chair Vang mentioned, last legislative session, you directed the commissioner to convene some stakeholders and put together a report and putting in some recommendations in regard to the maximum reimbursement for the ACRA program using the acronym. I'm going to spend just a few minutes kind of going through a little bit of a history just to try and get all the members a little familiar with the ACRA program if you're not, and then I'll focus most of my time on what the comments from the public were in regard to that particular issue and other issues that were brought up. Just quickly, the ACRA program was created in 1989 as part of the Groundwater Protection Act. It is administered by a five-member board, three folks from in the agricultural industry, and then a representative from the Department of Ag and from the Commissioner of Commerce. Something that's important to understand in the reimbursement program here in Minnesota, if you've compared it to any other programs across the country, which there aren't very many, but in Minnesota statute, the reimbursement is per incident. It's not per site. It's not per location. It's actually per incident. Now, there is a definition in the statute that talks about historical incidents, things that may have occurred prior to the program being created in 1989, and the board is only allowed to reimburse for one maximum cap for all the incidents that occurred on that site. And that's mostly what we deal with in this program. But for every new incident, a new discharge, a new spill, a new truck rollover, those are all separate incidents and they have a separate reimbursable structure to them. So just keep that in mind. The other thing to keep in mind, to be eligible to receive reimbursement, an eligible person must have cooperated with the department, done work to clean up the incident, and essentially they must have reported it to the Department of Ag. That's really the only requirements that they have. There are some exceptions in the statute where municipalities are not eligible to receive reimbursement. Common carriers are not eligible to receive reimbursement. But for the most part, the normal person, you and I, any of the board members, any of the ag facilities out there, as long as we report any spill we have, we're eligible to come in for reimbursement. So since the inception of the ACRA program, it has disbursed over $50 million to cover eligible corrective action cleanups. In that, there have been about almost 1,500 applications that include 630 different sites. Now, these are the facility cleanups. There's been quite a few other emergencies, but to talk about that cap, which is what this report was about, that maximum reimbursement amount, most emergency incidents don't hit that. So that's really not the issue. It's the issue of these historical site cleanups. So there's been 630 of those. 31 have gone over that maximum reimbursement, which is currently set at $350,000. So in looking at that, that comes out to about a 4.9% of the sites that have reached that cap. So of those 31 sites, just to put those into perspective a little bit, 25 of those were ag chemical, the normal co-op, dealership, retail facilities, and 6 of those were wood treating sites. So yes, wood treating sites are eligible for reimbursement because wood treating compounds are pesticides. They pay into the fund. They are eligible to get reimbursed out of the fund as well. The fund works really well because the legislature, when if this was created, allowed the commissioner to set that surcharge to keep money coming into the account to pay for the reimbursement, but directed the commissioner to keep the balance between a minimum balance of $1 million and a maximum balance of $5 million. I just bring that up to you now, and then when we get into the discussion of raising the cap, that point will come out a little bit as to why that might be a little troublesome as we go down the road. So just a little reference for all the members on the committee. These blue dots represent the sites across the state that have gone over the cap. So many of your districts, there probably is a site that have gone over the cap. It's distributed fairly evenly across the state in the agricultural areas of the state. This map is just a comparison of those blue dots, which are the sites that have gone over the cap. The orange dots are all the sites that we've cleaned up throughout the program and have received reimbursement through ACRA. So you can see that the distribution is pretty evenly dispersed. It isn't that, you know, the sites in southern Minnesota are going over the cap when the northern Minnesotas aren't, so on and so forth. It's really distributed where the sites that we do the investigations are located. As this discussion started last year, probably 2 years ago, we did an analysis of the average cost to do a cleanup. It's not all that important, the exact dollar figure on the vertical axis there, because we don't know the maximum amount that it costs the site to clean up. Once it goes over the cap, we don't keep track of the cost that an individual spends above the cap. So the actual dollar figure might be high, but what's important here is there's obviously an upward trend. Cleanups are costing more money, just like everything else in the world is starting to cost more money for various different reasons. We did the analysis, and yes, indeed, they are starting to cost money. If folks like a different statistic rather than average, we use a median. Obviously, there's an upward trend in that as well. So clearly, the cost to do these cleanups are going up and going up for various different reasons. There was also some discussion in the stakeholder meetings and prior to that, that there's a lot more sites going over the cap today than there have been in the past. Well, this is a graph that shows how many sites have gone over the cap by year. So this graph goes through 2020. I can tell you, I just had some folks look in the numbers this morning. In 2021, we had one. In 2022, we've had three. So there really isn't much of an upward trend. Maybe there is. It might actually be more cyclical as the incident response unit within the department does sites, or as transactions happen and sites turn over. But there may be. We, you know, we had three again this year, so there may definitely be a trend in the numbers. But I remind folks, again, there's less than 5% of the sites that do go over to CAP. Just for a little bit of background, again, this program is funded by surcharges on the various licenses and the registration products in the state of Minnesota. And I just show you this because this is what the current surcharges are for the licensing and the sales of fertilizer and the gross sales of pesticides. This chart will be important as we talk a little bit further. Notice the top four items on this list are all license items. The legislature did put a cap on what those fees could be, and they can only be at 50% of what the actual license fee is. So currently those top four numbers cannot change. They cannot go any higher without some sort of legislative change. So if there is a need to raise the cap beyond where it's at today, the fertilizer tonnage and the pesticide registration gross sales are the only two items that could actually be increased. It's not maybe the most significant thing in the world because they are the two that bring in most of the money anyway. And I'm just providing this as an example. When you see the fees, sometimes, well, what is that? If we relay that to farmers, what does that cost per acre? So this is just a quick little analysis that per acre using the FinBin data from the University of Minnesota back in 2019 and what the current surcharge is for various different crops. This is what a farmer, if those fees are passed on to a farmer, pay into this ACRA program to keep it up and running and reimbursing the various different dealers. So that's there for future reference for you folks. And as I said, when I talked about the surcharge numbers, you'll notice the ACRA gross sales for pesticide gross sales and the fertilizer tonnage, the last two lines, they make up about 88% of all the revenue that comes into that program. So although the license surcharges are at their max, they can't go up, there isn't a whole lot of revenue that come in from those individual licenses. But as you all know, you've talked about in many different hearings, the economy and the prices of fertilizer, the prices of pesticide, as they change, the amount of fertilizer gets used change, obviously those revenues can change substantially. The one requirement that the legislature put on the commissioner when we looked into this, these stakeholder meetings and putting this report, is they wanted us to do an analysis of inflation. So we did two different analyses. One, we took the original cap, which when this program started, it was set at $200,000, and it's remained at $200,000 up until the year 2000 when it changed to $350,000. So we did an analysis using the consumer price index of that, both the 200,000 and the 350,000. If you look at the $200,000 in 1998, you need $338,000 to have that same buying power that you had with the $200,000. If you look at the $350,000 when it was established in 2000, in today's dollars, you would need the $567,000. So that's the impact of inflation alone, not to say any other changes in the cleanup programs that may have increased the cost. So when we had these stakeholder meetings, we gave all of the attendees, and we posted on our website ahead of time, just sort of a few other things to think about, not only to think about the maximum amount of reimbursement, but some things that we have heard of in the past that others are concerned about. Currently, alternative sources of drinking water is not eligible expense under ACRA. Right now, as I mentioned earlier, the commissioner must keep the balance between 1 million and 5. There is a recontamination clause in there, but it only kicks in within 5 years, meaning if we clean something up and we have to go back and clean it up in 5 years, then the board can reduce what what they reimburse. If it's 6 or 7 years later, the board cannot reduce anything. So these were a few things that we listed to try and get the conversation going in these stakeholders meetings, to try and say, okay, what else is there? Not only is there the concern about the cap, but are there some other things that we should be looking at in the ACRA program as we went forward? So now the crux of what the report came up with. All the comments we received were in support of raising the maximum reimbursement amount. We did not receive one comment against raising that cap. There were several reasons given for raising the cap. Inflation was one, you know, changes in the program, things like that. But the one thing that was common is the vast majority of the comments suggested that the cap, if it being raised, should be raised in line with that inflation to the $567,000. So that was a consistent thread of all the comments we have. The other comment they made is if there is a concern with that cap being raised to 567 based on inflation, currently the Department of Ag for the Incident Response Program and for the administration of the program can use $450,000 in administrative expenses. Many of those same comments said if the cap is adjusted for inflation, then perhaps that administrative support should also be adjusted for inflation, which would allow that to $590,000. That again is a statutory change that would have to happen to make that. So a couple of potential issues with some of those things that I mentioned. Obviously, the biggest issue is the raising of the cap. If you make the cap $567,000 or the legislature changes it to get to that point, understand that that's over half of the minimum balance that can be in that fund. One of the things that we really get or we hear from the regulated clientele in the state, the commissioner has to raise and lower and raise and lower that fee because that is a pretty small window of $1 million to $5 million when one site can come in for half of what that minimum balance is. So if there was a little bit more room in there, would we not have to raise and lower the fees quite as often? Based on the current number of sites seeking reimbursement with our fund balance and if the site is raised, it would be impossible to support this program without substantially increasing the fees unless there is some other revenue source that could be used. Currently, there is not. I will mention that at the beginning of the ACRA program, the legislature, to get it started, did include some general fund money in to the program to get it kickstarted. So if there's an interest in raising a maximum amount of reimbursement and not looking to force, if you will, the hand of the commissioner to raise those fees, kicking in some general fund money might be an option. The other comment is, as I mentioned earlier, when we raise the fees, the only two current surcharges that would be impacted would be that fertilizer tonnage and the pesticide gross sales, because currently in the statute, the other four are at their maximum amount by statute. To change that would make a statutory change. The other thing in today's economy, with fertilizer prices going up, if the amount of fertilizer used goes down, obviously that'll hurt our revenue. Pesticide gross sales, on the other hand, because it's not paid on a tonnage, it's paid on gross sales. If the values go up, the sales go up, our revenue would go up. Obviously, that would help. But any change in that to support that program would have to be burdened on those two surcharges alone. The other thing just to mention is there has been some discussion in this group about possibly making, if there is a change to that cap, making it a retroactive change. The only thing I would say in that regard is obviously if changing the cap would require the fees to go up, moving it backwards, if you remember the slide I showed about how many went over the cap for the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, that just opens up the window that of the amount of expenditures that would be there for the fund. So with that, I will stand for questions if anybody has any questions on the report or any of the stakeholder meetings.
Thank you, Mr. McIndass. I will open the floor for discussion. I believe Chair Sundin is back. Chair Sundin, if you're back, I can return the baton to you. Okay, I guess not. So I will continue to chair. Mr. McIndass, I do have a couple questions. One, I will start, the first question will be if the applicant needs to match any amount received or if they could get full reimbursement for expenses. And then my second question will be if we know what percentage of the claims are due to natural disasters and which are human or mechanical. Mr. McIndass?
Madam Chair, I'll take the first one first on the structure of the reimbursements. The way the structure is set up is the applicant must pay the first $1,000 and then they can get 80% reimbursement up to that $350,000. And then any cost of the cleanup over $350,000 then comes back to the applicant. So it's a it's an 80-20 match up to that $350,000. 80% get reimbursed, 20% by the eligible person. In regard to the second comment, the numbers that I threw out to you are truly focused on the site, the co-op, the dealership. There were no natural disasters that were included in those 630 sites that we're talking about. They were all dealt with historical contamination site cleanups. I don't have the number off the top of my head, how many incidents, emergency response we have. I can get those numbers to you, but I will mention that many of those have insurance coverage. If they're a vehicle accident or there's some sort of a disaster, and insurance has to come first. So in some of those emergency cases, many facilities do have some insurance that covers those cases. So we don't see a whole lot of those coming in front of the ACRA board, but I can definitely get you those numbers, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. McIndass, good to see you. 1989 was not that long ago, I don't think, but I read a different ACRA report that had a story at the end of it about the Esselman site. And my concern is with these long-term sites that don't appear they can get cleaned up and that we're into a treatment model. How many, I mean, how do we take care of sites like that? And I say we here because the it appeared the responsible parties are gone. May not have even known what happened as we're moving into 30 and 40 years later. What do we do with these legacy sites that are agricultural chemical sites?
Mr. McIndass.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, thanks for the question. And yes, 1989 was not that long ago. We were both working at the department at that point. So I do remember that. That is one very nice benefit to the current ACRA reimbursement program. What it does is allows folks to get reimbursed so that we can avoid many of those estimates. The report you're alluding to is our annual report that we have to submit every year on the program itself. But what we do with those, one option is what we're doing in, with Esselman's when there is no responsible party. We can use ACRA funds. The commissioner can use ACRA funds to do that investigation cleanup. The Department of Ag also has full state Superfund authority. So we also have some sites that are very large sites, some of those wood treating sites, where we have actually listed them on the state Superfund list. And then we've acquired funds to clean them up through that way. But, you know, that's one huge benefit to the ACRA program. It's probably a huge benefit to making the program even better with any changes that are out there is that we try and get the responsible party to step forward and clean them up and get reimbursed. So,
Chair Hansen.
Thank you. Follow up. And Mr. McAdam, so you know, you brought up the wood treatment. So I think that was pentachlorophenol, correct? It's has the department gone back to some of the sites? And I asked the same question in the petroleum remediation audit that was heard last week. Do we go back to sites because the technology has changed? Our ability to find chemistry has changed over the last 30 years. Do we go back to some of these sites that we cleaned up, I'm using quote marks there, and look at them again and see that maybe they were not cleaned up, that there's vapor intrusion or some other chemicals? Because not only has our detection ability improved, but we find out that even lower and lower levels may have impacts on human health or the environment. Do we have a look back program? Then I have one final question after that, Madam Chair.
Mr. McIndetz.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, very good question. And we don't actually have a program that we, you know, every 5 years or every 10 years go back and do that. We have done that through, for instance, Groundwater Protection Act, where we have to look into nitrate levels in city wells, and we may have to go back and see if there's any point sources in those areas. So we have gone back to some of those sites. Many sites have actually gone back as part of a property transaction. We maybe have cleaned it up before when as part of a property transaction, they reinvestigated and we have found some recontamination, if you will. I don't think I could say that we've found a significant amount of change in what we're doing. We always look for new chemistry. As new chemistry changes in the agricultural industry, we have to change what we're looking for at some of these sites. But a large share of what we're still cleaning up at a lot of these sites are the chemistry that's been around for a long time.
Chair Hansen.
And then the final question, you brought up property transfer. Does the department require, if a property is sold that has been cleaned up or is in the process of cleaned up, does the department require disclosure to the new buyer or a deed restriction or deed notification for the new buyer that rides with that property that it has been cleaned up with the public dollars for this site?
Mr. McAdams.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, if it's a site that we know there is contamination that we have left behind, let's say underneath a building because we haven't been able to get at it because it's still an operating facility, we may very well put a contingency on the property or in some cases put a deed affidavit on the property that would go with that as part of the property transaction. If we clean up a site, issue them a no further action, we don't require them to file that on the property, but we do have a website. It's a What's in My Neighborhood website that anybody can search to find out where the contamination is around there, very similar to what the Pollution Control Agency has for all of their contaminated sites as well. So some cases there's a requirement if we know we've left contamination behind, but if it's actually cleaned up or we don't know, there's no requirement that they have to look before they sell.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McAdams, thank you. And since you mentioned that once a cleanup cost goes above $350,000, you kind of stop tracking it. So do you have any idea of those 31 sites that went over that mark, were they 351, 360, 400, 500,000? Any idea of the size of those that went over the cutoff point, how big those actually were?
Mr. McIndetz.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, actually, no, I do not. I do not. We've had several discussions with industry that came up as part of these stakeholder meetings, and based on the comment that you know we received of this $567,000, is that a realistic number or not? I don't know, but we do not track the number after it goes over that 350.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. So being this fluctuates between 1 and 5 million, I assume this is a blink on, blink off type of check off.
Mr. McIndetz.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, that is correct. The commissioner can either increase it, decrease it. It's not necessarily a turn on, turn off. We would raise it or lower the value, which also is somewhat difficult for the industry to keep up with that change.
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation, because I don't ever recall in the years that I've bought fertilizer that fee has never not been part of the bill. So I assume it's been there all the time. And any idea, you say the comments you got were mainly in favor of the increase. How many comments did you get, and what kind of comments were they?
Mr. McNabb.
Madam Chair and the board, the comments are actually attached to the board. There were a couple dozen comments that we received. Many of them were very consistent, requesting that the cap get raised to the $567,000, perhaps that the maximum amount of the fund balance could get raised to $8 million to help that fluctuation a little bit, and then also to increase the administrative expense also in regard to inflation. That was a pretty common, those three sets of requests. There was one comment that we received that did not want to see the fees increased, but that same letter that came in also said, but we want to see the maximum reimbursement go up. So they wanted the reimbursement going up, but they didn't want to see the fees increase. But that's the only comment we received in regard to not raising the fees.
Representative Anderson.
One final question, Madam Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. Since the two largest categories of income to this fund are the fertilizer and pesticide accounts, fair to say then that the farmers that make these purchases contribute the largest share to this fund. Would that be correct, Mr. McIndas?
Mr. McIndas?
Madam Chair, Representative Answer, yes, I would assume that's why I included that table, that those surcharges on gross sales and fertilizers get passed on down to the farmers, and that table would give you a reference of what that cost to them are.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
And then just final comment then, or observation. And so the farmer contributes most of the revenue to this fund, but most of the cleanups are at ag retail facilities. Would that be a fair assumption, Mr. McIndas?
Mr. McIndas.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, you are correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick question. Mr. McIndas, is ag the only entity that pays into the ACRA fund, or do other operations such as forestry, lawn care, the landscape association, that group pay into it as well?
Mr. McIndas.
Madam Chair and Representative Eklund, anybody that has a pesticide license, a dealer license, like lawn care facilities, all those categories that you mentioned, they all have that surcharge on for ACRA. They're all eligible. There are sites, greenhouses, nurseries that have done investigation and cleanups and have been reimbursed through the program as well.
Chair Eklund.
Well, oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. McIndas.
All right. I don't see any further questions. So thank you so much, Mr. McIndas, for the report. Members, if you have follow-up questions, please connect with the department offline. Next item we have on the agenda is Representative Backer's bill, House File 1886. All right. And there is a fiscal note in process on this bill, so we don't know if it's a finance or a policy. So we'll just lay it over for future consideration. Representative Anderson, would you like to move House File 1886 to get the bill before the committee?
I would move that bill, Madam Chair.
All right. Welcome to the committee, Representative Backer. Please tell us about your bill and introduce your witnesses.
Yes, I'm not in a very good cell area, so I'm not turning on the video, just so you know that, Madam Chair. But I think we heard quite accurately what this fund does. One of the reasons I'm moving this forward or asking for consideration is for the simple reason is that we have heard with inflation, this fund has not kept up to the cost of these cleanups. I know the commissioner, everybody's making it work, but with the increase from $350,000 to $600,000, we are just basically keeping up with the cost of inflation, just about 6% under. So with what we've been seeing, by the end of next year, this could be level with inflation. We have quite a few constituents in my neck of the woods on Western Minnesota that has asked for us to include, enhance this fund, because I think the last time was sometime in the mid-90s and so forth. My bill is not to intend to raise fees, just to raise this, because if I remember correctly, fees were last raised in 2020. So I know a lot has been said about this, so I'm not going to repeat that, but this is what it does, helps with these chemical cleanups, dealing with ag-related and other type of chemicals in with environmental items like that has been talked about the last 20, 25 minutes. I stand for any questions, but that's what this bill does, is increases that fund. And Senator Westrum has this bill on the Senate side.
Okay, I see testifiers. We'll start with Jim Lackey. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hello, my name is Jim Latke. I'm a farmer in Todd County, general manager at ProAg Farmers Cooperative, and I'm the farmer rep on the ACRA board, and I'm here to testify today in support of this bill. Having been on the receiving end of it as a farmer and dealing with it at co-op facilities that were built in the 60s and 70s, I've managed a couple different co-ops, and they just weren't built to the same standard that they are today. Didn't know any better. So it's one of those cases of when you know better, do better. But inflation has been impacting it. You can see that in the MDA report. Everything involved with these cleanups has wheels under it, whether it's the backhoe to excavate the soil, the drill rig to take the samples, the cost, lab work. I mean, salaries in 2022 are not the same that they were in 2000. And speaking on behalf of the co-op, you know, it's a farmer-based organization. Most of them in the state work off of 2 to maybe 5% margin at the end of the year. And unfortunately, they didn't build reserves for this over the years. So they, when it comes to these historic facilities, the ACRA fund is a really beneficial thing so that we can clean up contaminated sites and communities across the state. I don't think anybody wants to see groundwater contaminated. We don't want to see the plume get any bigger, for instance, like the Esselman site. So it's a really good program that just needs tweaking, in my opinion, having sat through a number of meetings and watched applications come through. And speaking for myself personally, when I look at what it costs per acre, it's pretty minimal compared to what the price of fuel is doing or nitrogen. And it's really, you know, communities helping out communities. And if you get one of these cleanups, I know there's a couple that are close to approaching the cap right now. Purley Farmers Cooperative is one, and Ada, I believe, has a site that's going to go over the cap. If it's a small co-op, it could be an extinction level type event for them. If it hits that $500,000-$600,000, they just don't have the reserves, and then you'd see service disappear in an area. And maybe that's capitalism, but I'm a little bit old fashioned and would like to see, you know, a decent ag retail presence out in the country to service our farmers. They just seem to plant the crop faster every year, and having those in close proximity to a farmer's field is a big deal. So if we can just increase this cap to get with the times and where inflation's at, I think it'd be real beneficial. I have nothing but positive to say about it, having been on all sides of it, I guess. So would appreciate your consideration in doing that. And those are my comments for today.
Thank you, Mr. Lackey, for your testimony. Next we have is Jason Kerwin. Please identify yourself for the committee and proceed.
Hi, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Kerwin. I work for Environmental Scientific, and we're an agricultural-based environmental consulting firm out of West Central Minnesota. And I'm here representing several co-ops today, many of whom commented on the ACRA report dated February 1st, 2022. I've worked on ACRA-funded ag chem projects continuously since 1991. And during those 31 years, I can confidently say that we consultants, whether it's Environmental Scientific or other consultants, and the Department of Ag, are doing a much better job now cleaning up sites than we used to. And that may ring true to some of the other representatives that asked that question, and I'd love to talk about it when I'm done. But in the case of doing these better cleanups, better means more accurate historic use of site reviews, more high-risk areas on a site, more sample collection, more sample analysis, more excavation, more land application. All of this means more costs. And the ACRA report that Roger gave did an excellent job laying out all the facts with the information they have. We have, in the consulting side or the co-op side, we have other information that may be of interest to you. And I'll just say two things. One is the report doesn't really talk about, and they wouldn't know, really, I suppose, active sites that are definitely going to exceed the cap. I have two of those, possibly three. One of them, we haven't done the excavation yet. The other one, we've done the excavation, but there's not enough money in the cap to do the land application. The third one, I think we can get everything done. Unless we're asked to do a groundwater investigation, then we're going to have a problem with the cap that we have. So that's something that isn't in the report. It's good information. I'd love to talk about it. The second thing is most of the sites seeking ACRA fund reimbursement are voluntary. Now, I can say that with 100% certainty for the sites I work on. I don't think the sites we work on are too much different than the sites that other consultants work on. So it's really a voluntary-based system, and I think that's the beauty of the ACRA fund and the incident response unit. But, so to sum that up for a regular person, what that means is a co-op enters into what's called the EGVIC program. And as part of the EGVIC program, they do, they actually pay MDA staff to review our reports. And the investigations are done in what I call an expedited fashion. Now, there's other sites too called comprehensive sites. They're involuntary. We do those also. I would say there's less of those out there. My point is, I know several co-ops that I've talked to, and I know there's more out there than just the ones I've talked to, would be interested in volunteering to clean up some of these old sites, but they're not confident the cap's going to be there to help fund that cleanup. So what does that mean? Currently, they're not going to volunteer. So contamination that's on those sites is going to remain in place for a longer period of time. That contamination will migrate, potentially create more impacts with that contamination. I think it's all bad, and it's going to ultimately end up being more expensive to clean those sites up. I'm here to support the increase in the cap. I think it's House File 1886. It's very similar, that the cap that's proposed is very similar to just the cap adjusted for inflation. And I thank you guys for letting me comment. I'd love to answer your questions. I'll be here for the rest of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curry, for your testimony. That is all that I have for testifiers. We also had written comments submitted, so please make note of that, members. Members, any questions for those who testified and to the author, Representative Anderson?
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I think this is a good fund. We need to have it, but I just have some questions about the funding. And if Mr. Sullivan or somebody else in research could answer this question, if we raise the cap, does that necessarily also mean that the size of the fee is increased as well? Do they have to go hand in hand, or can one be raised without the other?
Mr. Sullivan?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson,
As Mr. McAdams explained, if the maximum compensation is increased, that would lead to more liability for the account, which then by law, the commissioner would be required to raise the fees as necessary to maintain the balance between $1 million.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you. And Mr. Sullivan, that's kind of the take I got on it too. And it just kind of strikes me that we've talked about an indemnity fund in terms of grain elevators for farmers, and the farmers would, for the most part, fund that account. And this also is kind of an indemnity fund for in the case we have spills. And it appears that the farmers, again, would be paying the highest part of these proceeds as well. So just kind of struck by the coincidence of that, and would like to discuss this further as time goes on. But again, we're running short of time today, so I'll end my comments there, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Chair Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think the difference is the indemnity fund would be taking general fund, which is the general taxpayers, into that grain indemnity fund, and this is paid for by the users. And I want to go off of Chair Eklund's question. You know, everybody in this committee always refers to farmers, always. And to be clear, it is not just farmers that are paying this fee. It is not just farmers that are paying this fee. There's lawn care companies, there are the dealers, and there's been great consolidation among the dealers in the last 10 to 20 years as the farms have got bigger and are buying directly from the producers. So I understand Mr. Latke's question, because that independent dealer, whether it's a co-op or not, they've been shrinking in number providing that service, because you have the farms getting larger through monopolization and buying direct and avoiding the middleman and the commercial applicators who would do these applications. So you can't raise the cap without having the fund. So the users paying the fee, it's like the gas tax. You are having the users pay the fee, and it has worked. But my concern is, do we actually clean it up? So if we clean up the site, is it clean? Is it clean enough? And that, in the long run, that's my concern on this program. And we're running into that with the petroleum fund remediation, all of these things that we set up in the late 80s to hopefully do cleanup and providing user-based systems that now we, Chair Anderson, or Representative Anderson, we dealt with that with the dry cleaners last year, where there weren't enough dry cleaners to pay the fund. So my question is, we can't raise the cap without having the funds to keep the balance. Isn't that the math, Mr. McAdams?
Mr. McAdams?
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, the way the statute is currently written, the commissioner must keep the fund balance between $1 and $5 million. And the only revenues we currently have are the surcharge on the license fees, and then the surcharge on the pesticide and fertilizer gross sales, correct?
Chair Hansen.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't see any further hands. Representative Backard, closing comments before we lay your bill over.
Thank you, members and Madam Chair, for hearing this. As we heard from the testifier, there's a real need. This is a bipartisan support bill, so would appreciate this continuing to move on and pass. So thank you so much for all the testifiers, staff, and members. Thank you so much.
All right. House File 1886 is laid over. Thank you all for the discussion. This concludes our agenda for today, and this meeting is adjourned.